Hey guys, how's things?
Good. Well, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, the great Patrick Coburn's going to be here. He's got a brand new one about turkey I haven't read yet. But I know he's got stuff to say about turkey. I know about probably half of what's in this article. And it's short enough. I'll read it during the break here. The one before that was all about the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, de facto political leader of all Shia in Iraq, who's called together the new giant Shiite militia to attack Fallujah. So we'll talk all about the Battle of Fallujah, the current strength of the Islamic State, and the rest. The great Patrick Coburn from The Independent. That's coming up here in a little while. And then our friend Sheldon Richmond is also going to be on the show today to talk about cops murdering people and, stuff like that. And then also I got a ton of news to cover for you. Tons of news. All right. I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Check out my website, scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there and my whole show archives there, too. More than 3,500 interviews going back to 2003. You could join up the chat room to hang out with the boys during the live show. Hey, guys, how's things? Man, there's hardly anybody in there. I mean, not that you guys aren't individuals, because clearly you are. But there are a few of you. Hey, everyone else. Join up the chat room. It's already Friday again. How do you like that? Right? Yeah. Good deal. All right. So scotthorton.org/chat if you want to join up the chat room. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. If you like following people on Twitter, I'm one. And I guess I should say this more often. For the people who are new around here, it's libertarian foreign policy mostly. That's basically the deal with this show. Again, scotthorton.org for all the stuff. All right, now, so before we get to Coburn, I got some domestic-type things we got to talk about here. I guess first the big and the breaking news is about the Lafayette shooting last night. Some guy went into a movie theater and shot a bunch of people, I guess killed two people and then himself. Wounded a lot more than that. Used a handgun. And then they say that he's, there's a couple different narratives about the guy already. One is that he's kind of a drifter living in a motel. Didn't really have any business around that town kind of thing. And then the other narrative was about, oh, he's a Tea Party guy. And he had registered a Tea Party website and he had left comments on the internet that were pretty right-wing comments. Supporting the Golden Dawn fascists in Greece, for example. And then someone had tweeted me this earlier, and I didn't know what it was. I was like, oh, man, just, you know, right-wing freaks. I don't know. But then it turned out, no, this was the guy. And he says, basically praises Timothy McVeigh. And he talks about how, basically, I've heard libertarians, maybe even myself, talk this way from time to time, that want to see... on some things, want to see the government just go ahead and go bankrupt. Go ahead and sign up everybody for as many entitlements as you can and just break the damn thing. That's a pretty negative way of looking at it. But that was his comment. But he's, you know, basically has kind words for McVeigh in there. This kind of thing. So, I guess the debate is on whether he's an outright Nazi or just your run-of-the-mill Fox News fan. His target, I think, is pretty apparent that, you know, Amy Schumer is the new icon of the politically correct feminist Jewish comedian lady. Comedian. She's the new, you know, it thing in the media and whatever the hell. And so, pretty, you know, basic culture war type of a terrorist attack there. And yeah, it is a terrorist attack. And no, I'm not saying that because of whatever prerogatives of buzzword enforcers or, you know, linguistics, you know, politically correct, whatever the crap. And I'm sure as hell not saying it in a way to try to empower police to invoke terrorism legislation so that they can go and pick on other people who might think about social issues the same way as this guy or whatever, that kind of crap either. I only mean it in a dictionary definition sense. Attacking civilians, pretty obviously for political reasons. And so, and the purpose of that is to create a reaction, right? And so the reason it's important for people to talk about that, same thing with the Charleston massacre, the reason it's important to identify that is so that you can understand the context of what's going on, especially because what's going on is they're trying to get a reaction out of you, so you need to be able to protect yourself, inoculate yourself from the knee-jerk that they're trying to provoke, right? So, this guy wants to divide left and right. Roof in Charleston is trying to divide black and white. There's some overlap there, of course. As Juan Cole, who I hate to cite, but it's an important phrase. I like the phrase. It's an important lesson. Juan Cole wrote this after the Charlie Hebdo attack. He was quoting an old communist that he knew who talked about, I guess the context, it was something like, I forget exactly, but it doesn't matter. But the context was something like, communists committing terrorist attacks in order to marginalize the socialists, who actually like kind of agree with them on a lot of things or whatever, but they want to sharpen the contradictions between who's who. They figure they can't win until it's everybody versus the 1%, and the 99% agree with the 1% of communists who are telling them that they're all together. And so the way to do that is to make it more difficult for the Socialist Party to work within the system so that then they'll go ahead and side with the communists. Right, get it? Anyway, sharpen the contradictions. Make it more obvious that you and you can't get along anymore. And try to, you know, make that the actual case that people can't get along because of this, that, the other thing. Have you noticed? Is it just me? It might just be me. But I've noticed noticed people's race more. Like, it occurs to me, and I don't know whether people even pay attention to the news. I guess they do enough. This is a big enough social issue now, the new civil rights movement over mostly police murders, but also right-wing kook murders, too, that, you know, sort of, it seems like it's on everybody's mind as they're out and about more than it has been really in my lifetime, I think. Maybe that's just me because I'm stuck to reading the news every day, all day, and I might as well have Twitter implanted in my brain at this point. I'm so addicted to that freaking thing. Or that's not the right word for it. I'm not trying to defer my responsibility away to anyone else, but anyway. They're trying to sharpen the contradictions. You know, I didn't even realize till it was too late. There was a big Sandra Bland march here in Austin last night. I should have gone to that thing. Kind of lived too far away from the Capitol to really get down there. But I like stuff like that, man. I think it's important. I saw someone on Twitter saying the libertarians ought to be rallying around this Sandra Bland. Well, hey, I'm doing the best I can. I don't know. I think all libertarians would agree that they had no business. The cops had no business kidnapping that lady. Anyway, more on her when we get back from this break. And then Farmersville. Actually, I have good news from Farmersville, which is, I think, the most important story of the week, really, of all, out of everything, but, well, whatever. And then Patrick Coburn and Sheldon Richman. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself.
WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, Al Scalhorton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right. So here, back to Lafayette real quick before Sandra Bland. I know I'm all over the place. I'd like to invoke the lessons of Versailles. It's no rationalization. It's just the consensus of everyone in the whole world who knows the first thing about it, that there never could have been a Nazi party, or certainly not a takeover of Germany by the Nazi party, if it had not been for the overly vindictive terms of the Versailles Treaty, which stripped Germany of their territories, devastated their economy, took what was left. I mean, they were already devastated from the First World War anyway. They kept them under blockade. They basically took a defeated nation and then just shook the hell out of it for years still. And so then the Nazis came to power. And so on a much smaller level, we see this all the time in our own country and all over the world. We see it with the Golden Dawn in Greece. We see it with right-wing populist and actual dangerous fascist-type movements. Not that they're all exactly the same thing. They're really not. Across Europe, in the recent EU parliamentary elections, for example, that kind of thing. Which, not that I'm for the EU, but I'm just saying that's an example. And we see this in America when we have bad economics, and of course when they're liberal Democrats, and in this case a black liberal Democrat, in the White House, which is symbolically a lot more meaningful than really. It means a lot symbol-wise, for the people who feel like their group is on the outs. And the economy sucks, man. Everybody's alienated. People are not too busy working and making money and taking care of their ends to worry about fighting with each other. So they fight with each other. And it's a hell of a lot easier to blame the liberals or the feminists or the blacks or the Mexicans or the whoever than power, because you can't pick on power. Power picks on you. But, you know, for people without power to pick on each other, it's just lower hanging fruit. It's easier for people to choose their enemies on their own level, you know? It's like listening to the Crips and the Bloods pretending they run the whole nation when, like, hey, okay, you guys run some black markets in some places, but let's not pretend you run Citigroup. So, here's this guy who maybe could have been busy doing something but wasn't. And I'm not trying to defer from his responsibility whatsoever. You know, I'm just saying the circumstances. When you see rising crime rates with rising rates of poverty, it's not the inequality that's the point. It's just the poverty, right? I mean, if the very richest were getting richer and richer all the time, and so was everybody else, then big freaking deal. Instead, the problem is we live with this artificial government-induced boom and bust cycle. And that's mostly because they have to inflate the currency in order to make the empire seem free. Hey, everybody, we're going to invade Iraq. Never attacked us. And we're only pretending as a threat to us. And we're going to have to raise your taxes by 40% for the next few years in order to pay for it. Ah, you see how that's not a very good way to sell a war, is it? You're going to have to pay for it. Oh no, Iraq's oil will pay for the whole thing. It'll be free. In fact, you'll get a rebate check in the mail for your dividend. Your share of the spoils of the Iraq war. But meanwhile, Greenspan's just printing it all and building up a giant bubble, which then popped and created what they call the Great Recession. this massive dislocation, which just takes all the culture war issues and everything else that everybody else has a problem with each other, Americans have a problem with each other, and just exacerbates it all. Just makes it all that much worse. And it's really stupid because it's especially stupid because it's the kind of thing where it really should, if anything, create a lot of solidarity between everyone in the nation. Say, for example, even you might call them the 99%. Those of us who don't really have any political power. Those of us who don't own Citigroup. Who aren't senators' sons. Who aren't running this thing. And they're the ones who are screwing us. And they're screwing us coming and going. And they're profiting both ways. They profit from the inflation. And when the high interest rates eventually come, they'll profit from that too. Sitting on all the money that they printed. And then collecting massive interest on the loans for it. I mean, I guess it's always infinite interest if it's anything at all for money created out of thin air. But, so, anyway, I'm not trying to excuse the actions of this guy. I'm just saying, why do people embrace, you know, far-right politics or far-left politics? Why would anybody look at Bernie Sanders? Jesus Christ. You know, people look at Bernie Sanders and go, well, at least he's on my side, you know. He doesn't know what he's talking about any more than they do. But at least they think, hey, he's different from the rest. Socialism must be superior to Obama liberalism. If Obama liberalism is halfway between that and what the Republicans have to offer, people are left to conclude, oh no. So on the right and the left, and I'm not saying there's anything worthwhile about embracing the center other than just, I'm talking about people embracing very destructive far left and right politics, like hating each other's race or making a lot of prejudiced assumptions about who each other are and what you want with each other, what you would do to each other if you had the power. So, ultimately, again, like everything, it's the Congress's fault. They created the Federal Reserve. They should be abolished. I mean, the presidency and the court first, I guess. But I've had it with these guys, man. And they could have corrected this. They could have repealed the Federal Reserve Act at any time this whole time. But they want an empire, and they want to make it seem free. So they need a central bank. And so, that's why we live in a society where all us regular people are divided amongst each other, while they, the rich, keep going to the bank. In the immortal words of George Carlin, he taught me that when I was 14. They're always talking about what's different about us. Race, gender, class, whatever. And whether it's from a left-wing or a right-wing view either. It's from the top down, from the establishment down. In fact, for example, Hulk Hogan, this is stupid, but that's why I'm bringing it up. Hulk Hogan said the N-word on a podcast hosted by black guys, and he's telling a story about black guys calling him that. And he's in such friendly company that he kind of has permission slip. It's okay for him to quote black guys using the N-word. And he's now been like banned from wrestling forever and got his name taken, scrubbed from the whole website, maybe from the encyclopedia. How dare he do that? What if he'd been paraphrasing a right-wing racist? Mocking him? Would that still be a disqualifier? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police, state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Our first guest today is the great Patrick Coburn, author of The Rise of Islamic State. And, of course, he's Middle East correspondent at independent.co.uk, the independent there. And also you can find his archives at unz.com, unz.com. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Very good to have you back on the show. Some very important stuff to talk about. I guess if we could, can we start with Fallujah? If I understand it right, there is a major Shiite militia assault against that city underway right now.
Yeah, I was in Karbala, which is one of the Shia holy cities, which is about 50 or 60 miles south from Fallujah. And, excuse me, this is a very important battle because the Baghdad government began to go downhill and the Islamic State began to really come together in January last year when they took over, captured Fallujah, which is 40 miles west of Baghdad, and the Iraqi army couldn't get them out. That was really a crucial moment. And it's a very important position because it's within striking distance of Baghdad. It's an hour's drive away. So if the Iraqi government and the Shia militias, they don't like to be called militias, they prefer paramilitaries, can't retake Fallujah, then the Islamic State is in a pretty strong position. So they're massing around Fallujah. They've surrounded it. A lot of people have left. Islamic State is stopping a lot of civilians leaving. So it's gearing up for a big battle. But like a lot of things in Iraq, it's a bit of a sort of stop-go because the anti-Islamic State side is divided between government officers and Shia paramilitaries and the Americans and others.
Mm. All right. So a lot to go over even just right there. First of all, how big is Fallujah compared to, say, for example, Tikrit?
It's a bigger city. It used to have, I think, about 300,000, 400,000 people in it. I think a lot of them have gone because it's been bombarded by the government for a long time. Some say there are 50,000 people in there. I doubt if anybody really knows because people, if they're being bombarded, stay in their houses. Just how many are in the city is uncertain, but it's certainly in the tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm. And then the Islamic State, at least so far, they're attempting to put up a much greater fight for Fallujah than they did in Tikrit.
Much more important to them strategically. People had heard of Tikrit because it was Saddam Hussein's hometown, but it wasn't very well positioned for them to fight. It was some distance from where their main areas are, and they seem to have decided that they'd cause as many casualties as possible to the other side by snipers, by mortar teams, by IEDs, improvised explosive devices, that is, and booby traps, but to not put a lot of soldiers in there and fight to the last round. Mm-hmm.
But here in Fallujah, they're sticking, huh?
Seems to be. It's also, you know, for them, it's kind of a symbolic place because you remember in 2004, this is where there were two battles between the Al-Qaeda in Iraq of the day and the U.S. Marines. Mm-hmm. In the second one, a big fight, a lot of people killed. I think 100 Marines were killed inside the city. Nobody quite knows. A lot of Al-Qaeda were killed too. A lot of artillery used, a lot of buildings were blown up. So this is a kind of famous battle in the annals of Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-type organizations, or the Sunni as a whole. So I don't think that they'll just give it up. And as I said, there are good strategic reasons. It's close to Baghdad. Mm-hmm. It's close to the rest of the territory in Anbar province that they hold.
Well, and as you said, too, they took it even 6 months before they took Mosul and declared the caliphate.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so.
Sure.
Now, okay, so, but now on the Shiite side, as you said, it's very divided. You have the Shiite militias. You have what's left of the Iraqi army, which is, I guess, just their special forces divisions, mostly, as I understand it anyway. You could clarify that. Then you have the whatever small amount of Quds Force officers from Iran coming to help, and then the Americans in the sky. Is that the battle, the order of battle on the...
It's sort of, I mean, the Shia paramilitaries, I mean, these have at least 60,000 men. They're not all at Fallujah, but they have a lot of, you know, there are a lot of fighters there. They're pretty committed. These were called up by the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, Ali Sistani, last year after the fall of Mosul. So these are people who are enthusiasts, if not fanatics, and are prepared to fight very hard. The Iraqi army, as we know, most of it not prepared to fight very hard, but it does have one unit called the Golden Division. It has some interior ministry police, maybe 10 or 12,000 men in all who will fight. And then the question is, you know, previously the Americans have been saying, we won't fight and use airstrikes in support of the Shia militias, but then the Shia militias kind of answer to the government these days. So, you know, it's a big question. Can they get their act together and can they take Fallujah? Because what you need with the Islamic State is one win some real victories over it. One of the reasons that the Islamic State has expanded so fast is that it's so far it's sort of been a winner in the crucial battles. And when people say, oh, no, it's past its peak in May, suddenly it took Ramadi, the capital of Anbar province, and fought on 17th of May, and 4 days later, it took Palmyra in Syria. That shows an organization that can fight on several fronts and win victories on several fronts.
All right, now, so, geez, I don't know. Can you give odds of success or how long you think it might take? Or I guess it really just depends on Islamic State strategy, whether they decide to turn and run and fight another day or whether they try to really stick it out for the long term.
Sort of, there are too many variables. Islamic State, you know, it's one of the chilling thing about these guys is, you know, this is a monstrous organization. You know, I regard them as sort of Islamic Khmer Rouge, you know. But in addition to fanaticism, they have a quite high level of military expertise. They don't just fight at every place. Sometimes you think they'll fight, they go and fight somewhere else. And also, you know, with you American aircraft overhead, they don't really like fixed position fighting. They like to pull out and then launch a surprise counterattack, sort of quasi-guerrilla tactics. That's what they've been doing. But I suspect at Fallujah they'll fight. But you never can be quite certain, and you can't be sure of the sort of the pace of events.
Yeah. Well, now, so... But you're pretty convinced that, I guess, because the Ayatollah Sistani called them out, you think the Shia will fight hard, even though they are not fighting for their home territory here. They're, you know, out west of Baghdad in Sunnistan.
I was talking to some of the wounded who'd been fighting. I was talking to one guy, particularly interesting. He'd been a colonel in the regular Iraqi army. So he'd lost a leg from a mortar bomb in just the beginning of July. This was fighting at a place called Beji, which is north of Fallujah. And he was kind of interesting because he has a sort of professional military man's perspective on the militia. He said, yeah, I mean, very committed, but they're under-trained. They should have 6 months training. They only get 3 months training. They don't have things like, for instance, he said they're always talking on the field radios, very little security. So the other side, in this case, the ISIS fighters, can listen in on this, they hack into this, and they know when the militia is going to attack. Mm-hmm. But they're committed, and they've been fighting, you know, for almost a year now, so quite a lot of them are experienced troops, and there are quite a lot of them.
Okay, and now, so in your article, you write about, well, the article, pardon me, it's called Only Iraq's Clerics Can Win Against ISIS. And you talk a lot here about Sistani and about how the Shiite leaders, it's really on them to insist that the Shiite fighters that they have called to expel the Islamic State from the Sunni territories, that they restrain all their sectarian impulses. No power drills, right? Everybody
That's it. I mean, you put it well. I mean, one of the problems about American or, you know, British or whatever policy is they kind of pretend the Iraqi army is the main force of the Baghdad government and say, we'll give it training, we'll, you know, give it air support and so forth. Unfortunately, that just isn't true, you know. They were defeated at Mosul, they were defeated again at Ramadi. The main battle force of the Iraqi government are these Shia paramilitaries. And these, you know, they're influenced by the Iranians, there's some Iranian officers, but that's probably, depends on the unit. It's sort of, it's not 100%, it's not even, and some, in some the Iranians aren't there. One senior cleric in Najaf said to me, you know, he said, look, there are more American officers here than there are Iranians, and that's probably true. We've got these militia forces who are going to, whatever happens, are going to do most of the fighting if ISIS is going to be defeated. In theory, they come under the Iraqi government. They're kind of autonomous. So the thing to do is, I mean, there's no, one has to accept that. And but then make sure that this isn't a purely sectarian force. And the only people who can really stop that are the clergy. I mean, the same people like Sistani and the clergy who call these military units into being and probably at the end of the day can control them. Otherwise, you know, it's just all nice words.
Hmm. That's interesting because, you know, I guess my understanding is that the Iranian policy and really the especially the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawah policy has really been just kind of forget the Sunnis, to put it politely, that as long as they have the capital city and Shia stand down to Kuwait and an alliance with the Kurds, then, you know, forget you guys. And that was kind of always their goal. Like the Iranians, I don't think, ever wanted to have their guys attempt to rule all of Iraq because how could they? It's just, you know, to be able to rule Fallujah, Ramadi, and Mosul from Shiistan in the way that Sunnistan used to rule them, it just seemed like too big of a bite to chew kind of thing. So they just decided not to. Now they're being put in the position, they just kind of exiled them, I guess, in a way. Now they're being put in the position because of the Islamic State where now they're going to have to go and reintegrate Sunnistan, or they've decided apparently that they're going to have to do this. But that's a real tall order after the history of the last war and what's happened here with the civil war and the expelling of all the Sunnis from Baghdad, etc., right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Iraq now and before, you know, they're never sort of, there's never a good solution and a bad solution. A good solution, a lot of people stay alive, and a bad one, a lot of people get killed. Pretty well whatever happens is going to be resisted. You know, people have talked about splitting up Iraq into Sunni, Shia, and Kurd. But, you know, one Iraqi politician used to say to me, he said, sure, you can do that. He said, but it's not going to be a sort of nice little partition, you know, like Czechoslovakia separating into two countries. It's going to be more like the partition of India, you know, with tens of thousands of people murdered, you know, people driven from their homes. Was Iraq, you know, it doesn't divide up like that. You know, there are over a million Sunni in Baghdad. It's maybe 2 million. It's a majority Shia city. What happens to them? So all that's pretty difficult to do. Secondly, you've got the Islamic State, you know, in that those big areas, northern and western Iraq, the caliphate, so-called, and they're sending suicide bombs into Shia areas. So even if you don't go into their areas, they're coming into yours, and they're killing a lot of people. I mean, they killed about 100 people in during a celebration at the end of Ramadan a week or so ago. Mm. And so, you know, Islamic State, this whole idea, not just the Shia, but you occasionally people say to me, why don't they just sort of leave them alone and they'll sort of fester and eventually they'll collapse and so forth. Well, first of all, they show no signs of it. You can't really leave them alone, but they won't leave you alone.
Yeah. Well, now, but so, I mean, is it even possible, really? I mean, even if Sistani insists, the fact of just who they are, the Shiite militias coming to eventually, you know, Fallujah, Ramadi, Mosul, isn't that enough to push every single Sunni fighting age male right into their army to fight back, to resist? Because even if they're not bringing their power drills, they're going to be assumed to be bringing their power drills, right? The Bada Brigade and friends?
Yeah, but, I mean, what can you do? I mean, this is what Islamic State will say to the people there. You know, it'll want to frighten them. And there's reason to be frightened. You know, but you can't just accommodate, say, because the Islamic State has managed to terrify all the Sunni in its area, to then say we got to keep out of there.
Or I just wonder if maybe it'd be counterproductive to the point where they're going to have to turn around and, you know, figure out something else is all.
I don't think there is much else to do. You know, I think the Islamic State are a real sort of collection of monsters. You can see that from the way they enslave people, they rape women, they massacre people on a mass scale. But, I mean, I never one for comparing people with the Nazis because it's an overused parallel. But there are plenty of things in common there. I think that if they do fight them, then they should use disciplined troops. I mean, not all troops do this. Not all soldiers do this, particularly if they're commanding officers who order them not to and make sure they don't. Mm. The Shia paramilitaries, they have in some places killed people, but it's sort of the nature of Iraq and Syria at the moment that every community is terrified of the others. Secondly, that although there have been killings on all sides, really nobody carries out massacres on the scale of genocidal scale that Islamic State does. Sometimes you hear people, particularly in the U.S., saying, oh, these Shia militias and Islamic State, they're all as bad as each other. That really ain't so. The Islamic State is pretty well worse than anybody else. And, you know, they try and sometimes there's an attempted rebranding of al-Nusra in Syria, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate. But basically, these are very bad guys. And I think that, you know, you need a realistic approach that in Iraq, the people that are going to fight them are going to be the Shia paramilitaries. Mm-hmm. And the thing to do is to make sure that they're properly disciplined and not go around pretending that the Iraqi army is really up and doing. And all this sort of retraining or getting the Sunni tribes or something like that is going to work. These are kind of wishful thinking to my mind.
Well, now, and speaking of the rebranding of al-Nusra, you know, there's constant argument. I won't characterize it. I'll try not to. There's a constant argument that, in effect, that, no, you're just wrong, that Nusra, they really don't care about attacking the West. They never would, and maybe they just say nice things about al-Qaeda for the Gulf money that they need, but they're really nice guys, and or at least they're not that bad, not as bad as ISIS, after all. And besides that there's a giant army of moderates over there in Syria, that it's just too bad that America will not do enough to support the moderates, because we could have had basically an awakening movement from the beginning here, where there never was any oxygen or any room for Nusra and the Islamic State to rise up and be so powerful in Syria. If only Obama had committed to training up and committing those moderates to overthrowing Assad and creating a democracy there and this and that. So what do you say to that?
Well, it's kind of wishful thinking and fantasy, you know. They never really existed, you know. Once the Syrian revolution started uprising, and it was a genuine uprising originally, started being militarized, the guys who were running it, you know, from late 2011, Islamic State, al-Baghdadi, were sending their veterans over to organize people. These were the people who knew how to fight. These are the people who had resources and weapons. You know, there never really was much of a moderate, effective moderate military opposition. That's why Islamic State and the others took over. a lot of it, you know, moderate, but also kind of criminal gangs, you know. When Islamic State took over Raqqa, their capital, they didn't actually capture it themselves. Others captured it, but quite a lot of locals were saying, you know, that's great because the previous lot, you know, were really a bunch of bandits. You know, at least with this lot, you know, if they don't, if you get across them, they might cut your head off. But otherwise, you know, they keep order. And you find that all over, you know, it's sort of Ramadi after the Iraqi army was driven out. You know, somebody was telling me, I've seen his a brother there. The brother was staying and didn't much like Islamic State, but said, look, these guys, they came in, they got the local hospital going again. The government didn't do that. They brought in some heavy duty generators to get the electricity going. So, you know, these are kind of quite effective guys from the beginning. When it comes to the moderates, you know, it's Robert Ford, the former U.S. ambassador to Damascus, who resigned from the Obama administration because they weren't doing enough for these so-called moderates. Earlier this year, he said, you know, the game's over. The Syrian opposition is dominated by Islamic State or Nusra, and they're all the same. These are, you know, extreme, fanatical jihadis. And there's nothing much to be done about it.
Well, you know, I was reading Charles Lister, a terrorism expert from the Brookings Institution, and he wrote that there's a joint U.S.-Saudi room, he called it, in Turkey, where they help to run the so-called moderate opposition. And the new, I guess the Saudis, you know, take the lead in operating the Army of Conquest, which is the new merger between the moderates and al-Nusra, the completion of that rebranding, or the rebranding in practice, even if we're not buying it. And so is that really right? Does that coincide with your information? American Saudi
yeah,
are running
al-Nusra?
Yeah,
that's true. You know, it's kind of a messy situation. But that's one of the weaknesses of the U.S. position, which is, yeah, it wants to fight Islamic State, but then its big allies in the region are the big Sunni powers like Qatar and like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey, and they were sort of against Islamic State, but when it comes to these other al-Qaeda groups, you know, they sort of rebrand them as being moderate, you know. It just ain't so, but I think, you know, the U.S. has always been ambivalent as to what to do about this.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, that... they want to keep in with the Turks. And it's always sort of what the intelligence services do seem sort of kind of have their own policy there. I think that Jabhat al-Nusra, these others, you know, it's kind of often a bit comical, the attempt to rebrand them. I mean, the head of Abu Muhammad al-Jilani, the head of Jabhat al-Nusra was on Al Jazeera, which is Qatari owned, and sort of kindly interview that they gave him. And he was saying, yeah, Alawites from the government, they could come over and defect to us. But it went on. He said, of course, they have to convert to our brand of Islam and so forth. His organization, you know, went into Druze villages, demanded they convert to this very extreme brand of Islam. And, you know, and just when somebody resists them, they massacred them, you know. So there is an attempt to rebrand both in the U.S. and in the Middle East some of these sort of al-Qaeda affiliates. But that's what they are. They're al-Qaeda. They were started, you know, by Islamic State. They're not that much different.
Yeah, I mean, it's just basically the Syrian veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq from the last war compared to the more Iraqi-based leadership of the Islamic State, really, right?
Yeah, and so I think that... you know, at various points, the administration sort of admits this. You know, Vice President Biden at one point he had to withdraw it later. Said, "Look, the problem is in the areas our allies. You know, is the Saudis and the others. They poured in weapons, they poured in money to these extreme jihadis. You know, and the rest of the Syrian rebels. You know, he said, well, you know, shopkeepers and students. They didn't know how to shoot.
Yeah.
So
well,
from the
even
very beginning,
to the
jihadi takeover."
And even according to the New York Times and the Washington Post, all along, the CIA and the Americans have been in on this and helping to coordinate the shipment of some of the guns and a lot of the money And, of course, guns and money are fungible, and so they go to the guys who are most willing to fight, which means from the moderates straight into the hands of the Al-Qaeda guys who don't mind dying, you know, whether...
Yeah, I mean, and also, you know, there isn't a great... They're genuine rivals, Al-Nusra and Islamic State, but there isn't also a great Chinese war between them. I mean, the guys in Najaf and Kerbala I was talking to last week, you know, they keep saying, well, weapons turn up, but in theory, with the forces we're fighting, and these have been given to so-called moderates in Syria, I mean, high-quality U.S. weapons. I think there's maybe some exaggeration in this, but there's also some truth in it.
Yeah. Well, and there have been, not to be too conspiratorial, but there have been enough accidental drops of supplies to ISIS where you got to start wondering. I mean, I know close enough for government work and all that, but boy, have there been a lot of those.
Well, no, I don't really believe that one, Scott. You know, the people go on about it. There was once when they were defending, dropping stuff to the Kurds in Kobani, and one bundle ended up with ISIS, and there was a video of that. And people said, oh, well, that shows they're helping ISIS. Well, actually not. You know, they had 700 airstrikes against ISIS in support of the Syrian Kurds there. I don't think they were doing that. You know, I think their failure is not so much there, is that it's a political failure that they haven't been able to properly line up the people who are combating ISIS. Because in the past, they're worried about, you know, the Iranian participation and so forth. It's all a bit exaggerated, to be honest. You know, particularly if, to make a different point, you know, Iran is treated as if it was the sort of Soviet Union reborn. You know, this isn't a very big country. It's so influential, partly because it's sort of treated as the great demon by Washington and by Saudi Arabia and the others. You know, it's not going to take over the Middle East, whatever happens.
Yeah, and really, the most powerful thing about them is that America got rid of Saddam for them and stayed long enough to help them put their allies in charge of the entire city of Baghdad, not just the political leadership, but the population, too. So, I mean,
yeah, I mean, they
pretty hard to accuse them after that.
One, which was the Taliban and Saddam Hussein. The U.S. got rid of both of them.
Yeah. All right. Now, so one last thing before I let you go here, Patrick. Just the other day, and I think it had been since 2012, but just the other day, Obama said again that Assad must go for there to be a resolution to the conflict in Syria. And I wonder what you think of that, because it seemed like after the declaration of the caliphate, come on, I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to still push for de-Ba'athification and the abolition of the Syrian army in the face of the head choppers, even after the guy declares himself the caliph and everything? And apparently, yeah, that's still the policy.
Yeah, this contradictory policy. It's if they say, you know, the first thing, negotiations, you know, Assad must go, it's not going to happen. Second, if it does happen, the Syrian army will probably fall apart. I think that actually if there was a negotiated settlement, one thing that would happen after it would be that Assad would go, you know, because there'd be a new situation. You know, in a way, Assad benefits from Islamic being the alternative to Islamic State and al-Nusra, because whatever these guys say, you know, that we won't kill everybody in Damascus, a large chunk of the population, people work for the government, not just Christians and Druze and Alawites, but Sunni as well, think they're going to lose their heads if these guys come in, and they've got nowhere to turn to but Assad. But if there's peace for a time and people begin to see other options, then probably Assad would go. So in a curious way, these people who are sort of saying don't do anything that might help Assad are keeping him in power. I mean, people in Washington.
In other words, he could go at the end of the negotiation instead of that being the condition for the beginning of negotiation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thanks so much for coming back on the show, Patrick.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you again. All right, that's Patrick Coburn, y'all, from The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. And we'll be right back in just a sec with Sheldon Richman.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I ran out of time, man. I wanted to ask Patrick Coburn more things, but he had to go, and it's time to bring on our friend Sheldon Richman. He writes at SheldonRichman.com. Free Association is the name of his great blog. And his latest is Thought Crimes, Domestic Terrorism, and Police Bullying. Welcome back, Sheldon. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Nice to be back with you.
Yeah, good. Happy to talk to you. So, let's see. I guess you got some commas in here. Let's start with Thought Crimes. Dylan Roof has been charged by the central government. I appreciate it. You phrasing it that way. The feds have basically taken the case from South Carolina and made it a federal case and a federal hate crimes case, and you're against it. How come?
Well, I'm against hate crimes because I think
Start over because you kind of cut out on us there.
No, I'm against the concept, the legal concept of hate crimes, because it's less euphemistically, we could call them thought crimes. It's like something out of Orwell's 1984. In other words, you take this, take a person who in cold blood kills a bunch of people sitting in church, who were, I don't know, no particular ethnic group or, protected group. That person's going to only face state charges and could face the death penalty, which I don't approve of, but only, you know, that's not the point of the discussion, or life imprisonment. And, but if someone did it, because he didn't like that the people were doesn't like blacks, let's say, as in the case of Dylan Roof, then he not only faces life imprisonment without parole and possibly the death penalty at the state level, he could face the same penalties at the national level for only one reason. He had certain thoughts in his mind when he pulled the trigger. Mm-hmm. And I think that's wrong. I don't think crime should be, you know, what your the content of your attitude toward your victims were. It was an intentional killing, and we can. In fact, some people would say that even an accidental killing and an intentional killing is just a matter of ideas in people's minds, and you should never be, you know, punished for ideas. You should be punished for if you're going to be punished at all, you should be punished for your actions.
Hmm. Well, see, now I think most people would argue that that's absurd, and that actually helps make the counter argument that. We're actually not talking about prosecuting somebody just for what they think, but for the motivation behind an actual crime that they commit against somebody else. And I think almost everyone would agree that if somebody, you know, makes a terrible mistake and commits manslaughter, that's one thing. And that if they deliberately kill somebody, that that's an entirely different crime. And it's charged that way, I think. People accept that difference, and in many cases, there's at least, I don't know, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but pretty damn good evidence to understand why it is that somebody did do something. They were trying to rob a bank, or they were mad about an affair, or an insult, or whatever, right?
We can argue about this at two different levels. So for our discussion, I think we should leave the more radical level aside. That's the very argument that Randy Barnett, the libertarian legal scholar, was making back in the 1970s, and he still does, that punishment is wrong. In a free society, there shouldn't be punishment. You should be made to restitute your victims or the or the survivors to the best of their
ability.
I agree
with that. Let's leave aside the feds here, too. Let's just pretend we're talking about the actual jurisdiction like it should be anyway.
Yeah, so let's leave the more radical. We can do that another day if you wanted to, but let's leave that aside. So let's just accept the paradigm of punishment, the prevailing paradigm. So it says that the state of mind matters in that paradigm, the state of mind matters in this respect. It's a crime if you have a mens rea, right? A criminal intent, an evil intent, hostile, malicious intent versus an accidental shooting. Okay, I'll accept that for the sake of this discussion. So, but now we're making a further distinction. A malicious shooting where someone doesn't like the race of the victims, or the sexual orientation or ethnicity, national origin, or other classifications. And, there are crimes where you get extra punishment if you don't like the race or those things, other features of your victims. And then there's a different, there's less punishment if you killed in cold blood intentionally for another reason. Like you just don't personally like the, you know, if Dylan Roof had a personal grievance with each of the nine people he killed, let's say they owed him money and then pay right away, or, they said something he didn't like and it wasn't race, he wouldn't be facing life imprisonment and the death penalty at the national level, at the central government level. And why? Because he had a certain content of his, in his head, a certain ideas or attitudes in his head, apart from just a criminal intent, a malicious intent.
Well, now, but the other argument is, yeah, but we come from a legacy of all white juries and acquittals for crimes just like this. And so now we're trying to make the correction on that. You're saying far of a correction?
I don't think that makes sense. First of all, the criminal justice process is in motion in South Carolina. Nobody thinks he's going to Dylan Roof is going to get some kind of leniency, or that he's going to be let off. He's not contesting that he even did it, I don't believe. So they'll probably end up being a guilty plea. He faces the death penalty, or certainly life imprisonment without parole. So it's not as if the feds need to step in, like you could argue that in the 30s and around that time regarding lynching, because states were not prosecuting for lynching mainly because, the Klan was infiltrated the criminal justice system. Times have changed drastically. If he's convicted in the state court before a jury, why would the feds be prosecuting him? He's been convicted. And let's say he's acquitted. I mean, it's not going to happen, but let's just imagine he's acquitted. If the feds then charge him, that is double jeopardy. I don't know. I know they may call it by a different name, hate crimes, but it's still double jeopardy. I thought the people believe in the Constitution. You're not supposed to be tried for the same offense. It's just a different level of a government. It doesn't change the fact that it's double jeopardy. Now, he's not going to be acquitted. Nobody thinks that there's going to be a Klan jury that's going to say, nullify, right, and exercise nullification and let him go. That guy's not going anywhere. If it happens, we can worry about it then. But it's just ridiculous for the feds to be preempting the state. I mean, they're not totally preempting because it's going on in the state too. Mm-hmm. But for them to get in on the act anyway, I think it's just pure politics on part of Obama and the Justice Department.
All right, now, so then there's the question of domestic terrorism, and there's been a big fight over whether it counts as terrorism when a Nazi massacres a bunch of black people, and the basically, the argument has come down to whether Black Lives Matter or not. And if they did, then it would be called terrorism. But since they don't, it's not. That's basically the way it's understood, at least by the left. And kind of understandably, I think. I mean, it does seem to me it is terrorism just as a political definition. He's trying to provoke a political reaction here. It's not just murder for fun or profit. That was the point of it, was to kill civilians in order to provoke a reaction. So that counts. But then you also... not that I'm saying extra laws ought to now kick in or whatever, which is, another part of the argument. But then there's also this case of Chattanooga where the guy went and shot up active duty and at a recruitment center. And you cite Glenn Greenwald pointing out the discrepancy of whether that counts as terrorism or not. Here, Dylan Roof, what he did, for some reason, that's not terrorism, even though he was killing civilians for political reasons. But
this is terrorism, even though he was killing active duty military who, by definition, are not civilians and right now are on the entire world, which is a battlefield in the great global long war on terror.
Yeah, I mean, look, these are very different cases. Roof's action is much closer to terrorism than Abdulaziz's actions.
You know what? I'm really bad at doing radio, Sheldon. Why don't you do me a favor and just hang on a second, and we'll listen to a bunch of lame commercials and then come back, and I'll let you answer after that.
Okay.
Thank you. You're a very kind and patient man. We all like you a lot. It's Sheldon Richmond, everybody. He's at SheldonRichmond.com. Hang tight. Hey, all Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, we got to work. Last night's shooting in Lafayette in here too, man. I think that looks like he was a right-wing crank picking on an audience at a new left-wing feminist movie coming out kind of thing. That looks like a political type of a motivation there too. But anyway, so Charlotte, Chattanooga, Lafayette, go ahead, Sheldon. What do you think?
Well, look, I'd say the feds should stay out of it. If they're murders, they're murders. I just don't think the state should be making a differentiation for, you know, why you're murdering. If it already distinguishes first degree from second degree. You know, if you kill in a passion or a sudden provocation, even though it's not justified, that's usually second degree or manslaughter. We already have these distinctions. Keep the feds out of it completely. With Abdulaziz, there's the additional element that Glenn Greenwald has elaborated
that's
on.
That's the Chattanooga shooter.
Yeah, that he went after military centers. And again, I'm not justifying this. As Greenwald says, and I quote him in my piece, to say that something's not terrorism isn't to say that it's justifiable. Okay, so we're drawing distinctions here among, bad things. And I don't think walking around an American street and, you know, shooting people who are in the military, that I don't believe it's justified under those cases. Those people aren't, the people in the military at that point are not, you know, carrying guns and trying to shoot people. I just don't believe that's a proper, justifiable recourse. And it's even a bad tactic because all it does is build sympathy for the military. I mean, the media was filled with homage to the individuals that died, and their family was on, and the service,
that's working though. It's very effective. It's all about making everybody in America who's not a Muslim that much more alienated from Muslims and vice versa. In order to,
yeah, I mean, it's enough to make you think that, I don't really believe this, but I'll say it as a throwaway line. It's enough to make you think that Abdulaziz was a double agent.
Well, it certainly serves the hawks on both sides. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not enough of a conspiracy theorist. I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist at all. So I don't really believe that, but that is the effect. But I think apart from that, I stand with Greenwald that there is a basis in proper basis in law for saying to just go kill someone in his bed who is a member of the military is not justified, or even standing at a recruiting station. So I don't want to in any way sound like I approve of that.
No, of course not.
But it doesn't count as terrorism, no matter how the government defines it these days, because terrorism has tended to mean, and if you look at it through history, it has tended to mean the attack on civilians to gain some political or social end, either to terrorize people so that they'll, you know, pressure their government to do something, or, you know, some kind of goal like that. Mm-hmm. We are attacking basically defenseless non-combatants or civilians.
Well, now, see,
to go after
against
a military installation has not traditionally been regarded as terrorism, and I don't think we should do that. And I agree, you know, Chomsky has been criticizing the concept or has used terrorism as this has been used, you know, I don't know, since the 70s, maybe late 60s, for this very reason. It's now a contrived concept, which is constructed so that Muslims are terrorists, no matter who they attack, even if it's self-defense. Look, Omar Khadr was put in Guantanamo as a terrorist, right? He was in what, Afghanistan when the U.S. invaded, and you know, at worst he tossed a grenade at combat forces, American combat forces. How is that terrorism?
Yeah, whatever, no, you definitely want to say. No, you're right. It's completely used arbitrarily, and the arguments now about it and what counts as it or not are all legal arguments about who's going to get which book thrown at them. But I think really important to call it terrorism, or maybe we need a new term for it or something, so that people understand when people do political violence, they're trying to get a reaction out of you. So now the burden is on you to be smart instead of angry and react in a proper way, in a way that defeats their purpose rather than, you know, completely falling for it, which is basically what everybody tends to do. So that's why I think it's important to call not for politically correct reasons or legal reasons, but for just understanding about who's doing what and why it is that they're doing what they're doing. You know, when Dylan Roof knows that his changing of the world is marginal at best, but on the margin, what he's doing is he's making blacks and whites fear and hate each other more. And that's what he's trying to do. So our job is to go and have dinner with black people or vice versa kind of thing and make sure that doesn't happen. So that's my argument. Just like with September 11th, our job is send bounty hunters to slit bin Laden Zawahiri's throat and then call the whole thing off and just that's it and bring the whole empire home. And then instead of doing exactly what they wanted us to do, which is spend trillions of dollars destabilizing the Middle East, radicalizing a generation, bankrupting all of our fascist puppet dictators, and creating a whole new generation of bin Ladens. Same damn thing. That's my point.
No, right. And your point is it's not a legal concept. I disagree, by the way, that it's arbitrary. I don't think it's arbitrary at all. Anything the U.S. does and its allies, and most particularly Israel, cannot by definition, cannot be terrorism, the way they use the term. And basically anything done by a Muslim, even against an invading American army, is terrorism. That's not arbitrary. That's just right. A contrivance. That's just a propaganda tool.
And what's so funny is right before you was Patrick Coburn, and we're talking about how they're rebranding Al-Qaeda. The guys who are still declared loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, they're saying, these guys aren't that bad. We could work with them. We could in Syria.
Yeah, so now I see they've elevated ISIS. But what has ISIS done anything to on U.S. soil, to an American on soil? No.
No. I mean, the closest thing is the Pamela Geller attack. That guy had apparently talked to some of them on Twitter, but it doesn't look like he got any direction from them. And the rest of the so-called ISIS plots here are all FBI plots. So
look, we got to understand it's a political concept now. And it's used just in the cause of, you know, the American empire and its allies. And, you know, if you look at the state terrorism list that the State Department keeps, it's purely political. Countries or groups go on it or go off it as dictated by a political agenda, like the MEK, for example, that, you know, that group, which has committed terrorism of Iranians who turned pro-Iraq when Iraq invaded Iran and has been involved with Israel in committing, doing plots against Iranian scientists and whatnot. That group was on the terrorist list. While it was on the terrorist list, it was hiring prominent Americans to speak at its dinners, like Howard Dean and Giuliani, a whole bunch of them, right? and who therefore should have been guilty of a federal crime against giving aid and comfort to terrorist organizations. And what happened? This was under Hillary's watch at State Department. They lobbied and got them taken off the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody even confronted Ed Rendell. Hey, aren't you guilty of providing material support for a State Department listed terrorist group? And he just goes, everybody's well, doing it.
I think actually an inquiry had been opened up even. So someone in the Justice Department decided to take a look at it, but it all became null and void.
Hillary saved him.
She took MEK off the list. Right, exactly right.
All right.
It's all it's politics.
Yeah. Hey, everybody, go read Sheldon Richman's at SheldonRichman.com. And there's more to this essay, too, about Sandra Bland and things like that. So go check him out, the great Sheldon Richman. Thanks, Sheldon.
Thank you, Scott. Bye-bye.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberg, a tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I've got Marjorie Cohn, former president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, teaches law at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, and is the author of Drones and Targeted the editor of Drones and Targeted Killings. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Marjorie?
Good, Scott. I'm former president of the National Lawyers Guild.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Those things up.
No problem. I'm fine. How are you?
National Lawyers Guild. I should have had that memorized correctly. Sorry.
That's okay.
Okay. Now, so, anyway, Thomas Jefferson School of Law, and again, the book is Drones and Targeted Killings, so that'll have to go on my pile here somewhere. I'm on the Amazon page right now ordering it. And so you have the spotlight article today at antiwar.com, the U.S. aids and abets war crimes in the Philippines. Take us back to 2001.
Well, 2001, after the 9/11 attacks, Bush declared the Philippines a second front in the war on terror. And the Philippine government used this as an opportunity to basically escalate its war against Muslim separatists and other people who were opposed to the policies of the government. And the Philippine military and paramilitary committed egregious human rights violations, some of the most underreported atrocities in the media today. And so I testified as an expert witness last weekend in Washington, D.C. at the International People's Tribunal on Crimes Against the Filipino People. And there were about more than 300 people there. It was an international panel of jurors who heard testimony for 2 days from 32 witnesses, many of whom had been tortured, forcibly evicted, lost loved ones, witnessed the killing of their loved ones. It was a very, very compelling proceeding. Mm.
So people might be a little bit familiar with the first part of that story, not so much the war crimes, but the part about Abu Sayyaf, right? Al-Qaeda in the Philippines, got to go get him. Didn't hear too much about the war after that, though.
Right. Well, in 2002, the Arroyo government created a counterinsurgency program that was modeled on the U.S. program, ostensibly to fight communism, but they really went after progressive people who belong to progressive organizations, activists, human rights activists, labor leaders, anyone who opposed the government. After 9/11, the Bush administration gave Arroyo $100 million to fund the campaign. Then when the Aquino government came in 2011. They just changed the name but continued this counterinsurgency program, which has led to tremendous repression, including large numbers of extrajudicial killings, that means outside of any court process, forced disappearances, torture, and cruel treatment. And many civilians, including children, have been murdered, and especially people who oppose the invasive mining corporations. You know, indigenous peoples testified at this tribunal about how they were forced off their land to make way for the mining companies. They had no input into it at all. And one witness testified it was really an operational, this counterinsurgency program was presented in the guise of peace and development, but it was really an operational guide to crush any resistance by those who work for social justice and support the poor and oppressed.
All right. Now, so to what degree do you know, did the Bush administration, the CIA, the Special Operations Command guys participate in this, orchestrate this dirty war?
Well, first of all, the part of the Bush policy of the pivot to Asia Pacific as a counterweight to China, it led not just Bush but Obama to negotiate these agreements to station U.S. troops on the military bases there in the Philippines, which is a violation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And the U.S. used the Subic Bay and Clark Air Force bases, military bases, for its aggressive war in Vietnam. And then in 1992, the Philippine government said leave, and the U.S. now wants to go back. But in terms of how the U.S. actually aided and abetted these violations, and by the way, the International Criminal Court punishes people as war criminals for aiding and abetting war crimes, including providing the means for the commission of the crime. So between 2001 and 2010, the U.S. government furnished more than $507 million in military aid to the Philippine government, which enabled it to commit war crimes. And there's some direct link between U.S. activity and these violations. In January of this year, the U.S. planned and helped carry out the botched Mamasapano raid. Dozens of people died when commandos from the Special Action Force of the Philippine National Police entered Mamasapano, where the separatist Moro Islamic Liberation Front had a stronghold. The Obama administration had put a $5 million bounty on Marwan's head. Marwan was a terror suspect. And according to the Philippine Daily Inquirer, U.S. drones identified Marwan's hiding place, led the commandos to it, and provided real-time management capacity for the operation off the battlefield. It wasn't on the battlefield, which is, of course, illegal if it's not on the battlefield. Marwan was killed, but his finger was cut off and disappeared, and it then appeared at an FBI lab in the United States a few days later, where they performed DNA tests on the finger to confirm it was Marwan who has been killed.
Yeah, pretty clear who was in on that whole thing. All right, so now, I guess a couple things. I'm sorry, did you say, or could you give us a ballpark on what kind of casualties we're talking about since the terror war or in the Obama years or any kind of way that you could categorize it? And then if you could talk about your role in this tribunal that was held, where your testimony, I guess, is about the international law that ostensibly forbids Washington, D.C. from doing these things.
Right. Well, the tribunal documented 262 cases of extrajudicial killing. That means, you know, off the battlefield without any kind of court involved at all. 262 cases, 27 cases of forced disappearance, 125 cases of torture, 1,016 cases of illegal arrest, and more than 60,000 incidents of forced evacuation, many to make way for extraction by mining companies. And that's just in the last 5 years, from July 2010 to June 30th of this year. And those were committed by Philippine police, military, paramilitary, or other state agents operating within the chain of command. What the Filipino government has been doing and what the U.S. has been assisting with is very similar to what happened in many Latin American countries in the 70s and 80s, where there were torture, disappearances, killing, aided and abetted by the U.S. government, who was supporting these vicious dictators and military leaders in these Latin American countries, and, you know, ostensibly, again, to fight communism. So my testimony documented some of these things and also talked about violations of international law. For example, the military bases that the U.S. is going to be last year, Obama negotiated this, what's called an Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, which paid lip service to the Philippines maintaining sovereignty over military bases in their country, but actually gives tremendous power to the U.S. This violates the well-established right of peoples to self-determination in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Killing civilians and targeting civilians and not distinguishing between civilians and combatants violates the Geneva Conventions. Desecrating bodies, which also happened, violates the Geneva Conventions. The torture violates the Convention Against Torture and other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. And so if you the Philippine military and paramilitary apparently rationalize their harsh treatment as necessary to maintain national security against people and organizations that seek to challenge or even overthrow the government. But the Convention Against Torture says unequivocally, and I quote, no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency may be invoked as a justification for torture. So there is absolutely no justification ever for torture. And One witness who was very compelling was a 14-year-old boy who testified he was walking with family members to harvest their crops. And he said, we were fired upon by soldiers. We said, we are children, sir. But the soldiers killed his 8-year-old brother. And then the witness said, I embraced him. The soldier said we were enemies. He was bleeding. The bullet exited in the back. He was dead when my mother saw him. We made an affidavit against the soldiers, but it was dismissed by the prosecutor. And many of these witnesses testified that they had filed complaints and nothing had happened, and this is part of the whole impunity of the Philippine government. And in many, many international law treaties, there is a duty to provide relief and reparations to victims. I also testified to that, and the Philippine government has been violating that. But we don't hear about this. Many people who read my article, which appeared on Truthdig and Huffington Post and a number of other blogs, said they'd never heard about this, and they knew about the vicious Marcos dictatorship some years back. But this is just a continuation of the same, aided and abetted by the U.S. government because of so-called strategic interests in the area, turning our head the other way and even facilitating through funding and military actual soldiers these human rights violations. And they are egregious. I mean, they're just really outrageous.
All right. Well, listen, I know you're in a rush today, so I'll let you go. But thank you very much for coming on the show. Can you tell us real quick where people can learn more about this tribunal and more information about what happened there, other than your great article there at Truthdig?
Yes. If you Google International People's Tribunal on Crimes Against the Filipino People, then you will learn who the judges were. You'll see my testimony there and also the decision of the jury who found the Aquino government and the U.S. government guilty of these war crimes.
Okay. And I see. That's internationalpeoplestribunal.org. Thanks again, Marjorie. Good to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Scott. Bye-bye.
All right, so that's Marjorie Cohn. She is a professor of law at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego and is the former president of the National Lawyers Guild. We'll be right back in just a sec. Oh, yeah, no, and the article at Truthdig is U.S. Aids and Abets War Crimes in the Philippines. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up,
Click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys. Yeah, I'm blowing all the heartbreaks today, I know. Marjorie Cohn, she's great. She had to go. But she said check out internationalpeoplestribunal.org for more information about that. And check out It's the Spotlight today on antiwar.com from truthdig.com. The U.S. aids and abets war crimes in the Philippines by the great Marjorie Cohn. Okay, cool. Now, so let me see here. Things. Lots of things. I'm almost out of time for the whole dang show. Thanks again to Patrick Coburn and Marjorie Cohn both. Check this out. So I had missed this, but I think that this is great. Don't oppose Islamic Center. Baptist pastor tells congregation. This is about Farmersville. And I'd read to you these quotes. Oh, I'm sorry. Farmersville is where some Muslims wanted to open up a cemetery, and the town council approved it, and then the population flipped out, and this one Baptist preacher has been demagoguing against it. Well, so this other Baptist preacher has said, hold it right there. And I think he did a good enough job. I want you to hear from him here. Let me see what I got. I should have just had him on the damn show, but first of all, he says, I'm your pastor. It's my job to tell you when you're wrong. A pastor who tells you what you want to hear all the time loves himself more than he loves you and won't do the right thing or risk his own self, his own standing with you in order to tell you when you're wrong, and you're wrong. So you know what? All right. Hey, I like anybody who talks like that, you know? I mean, assuming he's right. Assuming I agree with him, in that case, that's perfect. But then he says that, you know, he believes in the power of God, so he doesn't see it in a light where he thinks God needs. Well, what is he says? It's not a very big God who needs Mayor Helmberger to come to his rescue. And I mean no offense to the mayor by saying so, he says, okay? That is a very American take on religion right there. I'm sure that God can deal with your blasphemy in his own way. I'm not going to have to handle it for him. That's not how we do business around here. He says those who want the power of the government to block the construction of Islamic... This is a quote. Those who want the power of the government to block the construction of Islamic facilities in Farmersville are doing things the Muslim way. Oh, this is the part I don't like. I'll just paraphrase it. And he kind of has a point, but not really. He says, you know, Islam is a weak religion, so they got to force you to believe in it if you live in a Muslim land. But around here, we don't feel that way about it. It, you know, what we're selling, you'll want to buy, so come on in kind of thing. Well, now that's ridiculous. I mean, what's the context here? The context is a bunch of ostensibly free Muslims living in Texas who aren't being forced to be Muslim at all. Who, in fact, worship the same God as these Baptists. But anyway, so that's the stupid, insulting part of it that I thought was stupid. But then, you know, when he complained, you know, attacks Islam. But anyway, it doesn't matter because the rest of what he says is really great. And they wouldn't listen to him if he didn't say all that horrible stuff anyway, right? And he says, city ordinances are not the power of God unto salvation. Planning and zoning recommendations are not the power of God unto salvation. The gospel is the power of God, and that's all we need is faith in that. We don't need government to sustain it, he says. It hasn't always been the case, but in American history, it's pretty damn much been the case. And then he says, it gets better. if we have constructed a comfortable bubble in Farmersville that isolates us from the world around us and prevents us from being grieved over the fact that people over the world live next to Islamic training centers, then I say let God do whatever is necessary to tear that bubble down. Again, I guess he is accepting the premise of, oh, just how important it is, how wrong their religion is compared to us and all that. But, or maybe he meant it kind of sarcastically or something, I don't know. It's no victory that matters if we achieve the relocation of a Muslim center with just as many adherents who are just as committed as they were before. But at least we don't have to look at them, he said. So, in other words, it's a failure if they're unable to convert people to their religion. Hey, Southern Protestantism is a very evangelical kind of a thing. But he's saying, so we're not winning if they're not converting, but they're just out of our sight. That's not the part where it gets better. I swear, if you go further in the article, it gets to the part where it gets better. Here he says he's invoking religious freedom on gay marriage issues. And he says, tell me, please, how do you expect us to argue? This is what he said to his congregation there, according to the paper there. Tell me, please, how you expect us to argue at the national level with a straight face that we believe in religious liberty for all people, while at the local level we're running the Muslims out of town on a rail. He calls them the Muslims. That's funny. I'm spending all this week studying and collaborating with the top lawyers in the United States in the field of religious liberty. We're trying to figure out how to preserve for our children and grandchildren the freedom to follow Christ. Meanwhile, back home, Christians are going to City Hall seeking to become religious oppressors. You know, that's kind of a double standard, but I understand his point, or, you know, he's kind of mixing metaphors, I think. But anyway. I tell you, my friends, whatever the city government does against an Islamic training center today, they'll be doing it against Bible-believing, Bible-preaching churches in 20 years. Mark my words. And if you tell the city of Farmersville today that you want them to have and to exercise this sort of power, your objections on that day are going to ring pretty hollow. Lastly, Barber said that the fear of Muslims tells the world that we do not trust God to take care of us, and that's embarrassing. So stop talking that way. I like that. And then he invokes all the great apostles and whatever and says, if we're the followers of them, then why should we be afraid of anything? Which is, you know, seemingly a pretty good point, I think. And then he's, you know, he's coming up against this other guy, Meeks, in town, is the one who's doing all the scaremongering and, you know, acting like they're going to build an Al-Qaeda training camp in town. They are at war with us, they being as broadly defined as it could possibly be. And now, so what are Muslims supposed to think when they hear this crap? I mean, not the good part, but the people attacking them all the time, accusing them of being evil just for believing in the same damn God that they believe in. Sorry for my language. I didn't even mean it that way, to throw damn in there in a, like, religiously ironic way. I just meant how outrageous it is that, you know, American Christians don't even know that, right? Muslims revere Jesus. They don't think he was the Savior, Messiah, Son of God. They got a different tradition there, but they revere him as a prophet just like Abraham. So that's pretty good, right? It's the same Jewish God. It's the same one. Yahweh, Allah, is the same guy. Guys, people even understand that? Come on. Anyway. And besides, religious freedom is our highest value even, or I guess if you're a religious person, it ought to be right up there tied with your faith itself. You can't have your faith if you're not free to have your faith. And ultimately, I guess that means, you know, being punished by having your life taken for believing the wrong thing, which is, as this guy says, the way it is in a lot of Muslim countries. I don't think that's so much because they're insecure as just people. Some people like killing people and they like having excuses to kill people. So, you know, they do what they do. And some people feel like, not that, oh, the way this guy phrased it, God is so weak he needs their help. But that, no, God sent me here to kill you. What?
No conflict there. You know. It's all just a matter of spin, one way or the other, right? But anyway. What sickens me more than the fact that these people are so gullible as to fall for this scaremongering is the leadership of the right in America who has pulled the wool over their eyes. And they're just regular folks, man. They're told all the time that this is the case. Islam makes them want to kill us. And they don't know anybody who ever says, come on, that's stupid. They don't know anybody that says that. And so after 15 years of this, geez, I was sure that the Bush administration knew what they were doing so good, the war on terror be over real quick. But now here we are 15 years later. I guess that Islam is real evil then. They got no other information. And that's the leadership of the right wing's fault for that. And I'm sorry I didn't get to talk about Sandra Bland today. I want to talk about Sandra Bland today. I guess next week. And Iran and whatever. But anyway, thanks you guys for listening. ScottHorton.org for the archives. Follow me on Twitter.